Welcome to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're revisiting some of my conversations with war historians today, and we begin with Thomas Childers. He's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of four books about World War II. When he joined me in 2009, he had just published Soldier of the War Returning. It questioned Americans' long-held belief that World War II veterans returned from fighting in perfect mental health to a country that embraced them with open arms. In fact, many members of the Greatest Generation suffered from what would later be known as PTSD. And there were political struggles addressing the needs of these veterans. Let's take a listen to my conversation with historian Thomas Childers. Was this a difficult book to write? And I ask that in part because the stories in here are difficult to read, but also because you are piercing some of these myths today about World War II.
Yes. I'd say the emotional toll on me just writing it was considerable, partly because it's dealing with my family, my parents, the parents of my best friend, Willis Allen and Grace Allen. These are very personal stories. I once asked Stephen Ambrose if he'd ever considered writing a book about what happened when these guys came home. There's no question about the great heroism and their achievements of this greatest generation. But there was almost nothing, as I began to discover, written about what happened when they actually got back. And Ambrose said, well, that would just be too personal, wouldn't it? And he also said, and there was also, it's not the same dramatic arc as you find with sort of combat narratives. Well, the first part of that's true. I'm not convinced that the second part is.
But we shouldn't be surprised to think that veterans, men and women, coming back from the war didn't struggle in the 1940s and 50s, didn't have to deal with some of the horror that they dealt with on the battlefield.
Well, that's right. This is a lesson that we apparently have to keep learning. I think there was an assumption that has grown up since the 70s that all of these things, post-traumatic stress disorder, shattered personal relationships, substance abuse and so on, were somehow uniquely products of the Vietnam War. Bad war, bad outcome, bad after effects. And then, lo and behold, we have to discover that that in contrast to the Second World War, where people apparently had come back happy, well-adjusted, and so on. Now we discover, of course, all over again, with the Gulf War and with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that these problems that we saw in Vietnam are very much with us now. And as I discovered doing the book, were very much present after the Second World War.
So is it a mistake to call World War II the good war, thinking that there was then the good decade that followed the war?
Well, I think when Studs Terkel really coined that term, he put it in quotation marks. It's certainly good in contrast. Well, it was seen as a necessary war. I don't think anybody could argue that defeating Nazi Germany and the militarism of Imperial Japan was not something that had to be done. But I think, as Paul Fussell here in Philadelphia has pointed out many times, because the objectives of the war were necessary, good, sometimes even noble, that doesn't mean that the actual experience of fighting it was. It's interesting if one looks, as I did, at the media from the immediate post-war years, 45, 46, 47, 48, and so on. You don't see any of this greatest generation sort of notion. There is a lot of anxiety and worry about what was going to happen when these guys came home. Fear of a crime wave, that these guys had been brutalized by combat, that they, even if they hadn't been in combat, they'd been away from civilizing influences such as home and family for 1 year, two, three, 4 years. Who knew what to expect?
Yeah. And these were popular magazines like Good Housekeeping or Reader's Digest. These were not psychological journals. This is what the public was reading.
That's right. Well, you can certainly find it in the psychological journals, though I suspect not very many people were reading them. But certainly in Good Housekeeping, Ladies' Home Journal, Collier, Saturday Evening Post, Reader's Digest, there was a tidal wave of articles about how to deal with him when he comes home. Will he be changed? Will he be nervous? Will he be distant. One of my favorite article titles was from Ladies' Home Journal from 47, I believe, called Peace, It's a Problem, about the difficulties of husband and wife getting to know one another, raising a family, and so on.
And I do want to talk about some more about what this book is about. But how do you understand the kind of amnesia this country seems to have about aftermaths of war, or particularly this particular war?
Well, I think this particular war is somewhat unique in that regard. I think nobody would make that argument about Vietnam. There is a mountain of literature, films, television programs, and so on about the veteran who can't readjust, the psychotic veteran. I'm not at all convinced, by the way, I can't prove this, I'm not at all convinced that Vietnam veterans, that a greater percentage of Vietnam veterans had more trouble than World War II veterans. But at the end of the Second World War, the greatest generation, these men had many great qualities. Being frank and open about their feelings, I think, speaking as a son of one of them, was probably not their greatest strength. And also the culture. It was the Hemingway society. Men kept their mouth shut. They suffered in silence and went on. You didn't whine. You didn't complain. There's a certain amount of that still, of course, within military culture. One of the things that to me is disturbing about this whole phenomenon is a year or so ago, the Rand Corporation came out with a study called Invisible Wounds. And it was about the soldiers coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, all the sort of psychiatric problems they were having. And one of the things that it noted was that there are now all kinds of army programs, military programs to deal with this, but that they suspect that the vast majority of men and women who have these problems don't, that they rely on family or the church. And that is no different from the Second World War.
I guess it shouldn't be surprising, thinking of all these soldiers coming home after the war was over, but just the process of reentry. There weren't enough houses. There wasn't enough civilian clothing for
right.
those people returning. And also, you write about the kinds of, I guess, over time, the impatience that the civilian population had with these returning veterans.
Right. Homelessness was not a term that was in use in the immediate post-war years, but it certainly existed as a phenomenon. In 47, it was estimated that 1.3 million veterans were living either with relatives or friends or squatting one place or another. It was extremely difficult. There had been very few houses built during the Depression and even fewer during the war. So when these guys got back, even though there was the GI Bill to help buy houses, there wasn't very much available. So this is not an exaggeration. There are stories in Newsweek and Time and all the major magazines about veterans living in their cars, families living in decommissioned trolley cars, former army barracks being turned into housing for married people. There was a famous incident of a couple in New York who were sleeping in the Macy's bedroom display. As soon as the store closed, they had slipped in and then would go and sleep there. Another couple slept on a stage on Broadway after the theater had closed. A couple slept in lived in a chicken coop out in Wisconsin and washed up at a nearby gas station. Homelessness is one of the biggest complaints that one found veterans making after the war. Unemployment. One always thinks of the GI Bill, and of course then the great takeoff of the American economy a bit later in the 40s. But in that transitional period from wartime economy to peacetime, there was a lot of unemployment, especially mm-hmm. among veterans. These guys came back, and the unemployment rate for veterans was quite high, over twice what it was, three times what it was for civilians. The case of a guy who came back and went through the counseling about what jobs he was qualified for. He'd been an infantry, or he'd been a Marine. And they said, well, you can be a Maine hunting guide.
Hmm.
So a lot of skills that didn't have civilian applications.
You quote a Brigadier General Leon Johnson. He was in charge of the Army Air Force's personnel services. And this was really, as you describe, a plea to the civilian population, talking about these returning soldiers. All they want is a place to live and a chance to have gainful employment consistent with their abilities and skills. Surely they're entitled to that much, and yet these are the very things that they aren't getting. This has got to change. And what I read from that was that from the civilian population, a kind of impatience about these veterans getting on with their lives and perhaps feeling that there was scarcity. And the perhaps unwillingness to share some of these scarce resources.
Yeah, that's right. There is a lot, of course, of the welcome home, the banners, the great praise for the soldiers and their sacrifice. But as 45 turned to 46 and the war began to recede, well, during the war there was the saying that anybody encountered any sort of difficulty at home, you would say, "Don't you know there's a war on?" So don't complain, yeah. By 1946, what veterans frequently heard was, "The war's over, soldier." There was a very famous article in the Saturday Evening Post, the title of which was, "Are We Making a Bum Out of G.I. Joe?" And it was about how veterans were taking advantage of the G.I. Bill, one part of which was, if you could not find a job, you were guaranteed $20 a week for 52 weeks. And so it was called, cynically, the 5220 Club. You began to get a sort of undercurrent of civilian impatience, as you said, with veterans complaining.
But as you also have made clear, while we are talking about those soldiers who struggled with reentry, there were some, and these are perhaps the ones that Tom Brokaw was writing about, there were some who were able to make that readjustment. Does anyone know why some and not the others?
The quick answer to the latter is no. Part of it has to do, obviously, with the actual experience. Part of it has to do with the psychological stability before. But attempts to sort of sort this out have not been terribly fruitful from a psychiatric point of view. Yes, one of the things I want to emphasize, and thank you for posing it this way, is that, you know, a great many people came back. They may have stumbled a little bit coming back. They may even had a touch of PTSD, whatever. And then they pulled themselves together, went on, and had very successful lives. And they've been written about, talked about, and justly praised over and over again. We know the story. The reason I wrote this book was that there seemed to me to be a great many people out there for whom this I think, true but also now romanticized view didn't apply. I would also have to say the three men that I've written about, my father, Willis Allen, Michael Gold, and their families, all three of these men were very successful people.
Interesting.
They weren't people who were somehow paralyzed by their war experiences. They went on. My father was a very successful businessman, finally. Willis Allen was a successful man. Michael Gold, as I said, was a very, very distinguished OBGYN. So the point, I think, is that a lot of beneath even the surface of these of the sort of greatest generation storyline or the arc of their lives, there is an awful lot of unresolved business.
That was my 2009 conversation with historian Thomas Childers about his book, Soldier from the War Returning. You're listening to Radio Times in Review when we're revisiting my conversations about war. When we get back, we'll hear from Anthony Beaver about the Battle of Berlin in World War II. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're discussing war history in this edition of the show. We turn now to the fall of Berlin and the atrocities that took place in that battle that ended the Second World War. Military historian Anthony Beaver chronicled the conflict in vivid detail in his 2002 book, The Fall of Berlin, 1945. Let's take a listen.
Was this a story you had not known before you began to research it, the extent of the brutality that you found?
No, there were a lot of things that I didn't know about. One had heard of the mass rapes, but the actual scale, the scope, and the intensity was something I was not prepared for. I think the most shocking thing for me, in a way, was when we were in the Russian archives and working with my Russian research assistant, Luba, we suddenly came across these documents, which were detailed descriptions and a report back to the Central Committee of the Komsomol of the Communist Youth about the mass rape of young Soviet women who had been taken for slave labor in Germany. So the whole argument about it being revenge for what the Wehrmacht had been doing in occupied Russia was very much undermined by this, but it was so appalling. Luba was knocked sideways and just simply didn't know what to believe, and I certainly didn't know what to believe after reading these papers.
And these papers were newly released or buried somewhere in some archive?
I think, no, they haven't been, they've been open, I think they've been in the files for quite a long time. I think that, I don't think that any historians happen to have worked through this particular section of the archive. I mean, one has to understand the Russian archives are so huge. I mean, the material there is vast. So a lot of it is a question of luck or pure chance of whether you stumble across some of these papers.
So it's just literally looking through reams and reams and reams of pages to find the kind of documents and information that you found. The Russian ambassador to London initially attacked this book and said this book was an act of blasphemy, among other things. How does he feel about it today?
Well, I think he still feels fairly uneasy on the subject. He did invite me to lunch after that and sort of said, you know, I think we understand each other, i.e. he was obliged to attack it. And there is no doubt about it. I think for Russia, it is very difficult to face up to the past. I mean, as he said, you have to understand the victory is sacred. And yes, that is true, but the victory is sacred only because of the millions of lives of Soviet citizens. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible sacrifice which they underwent. 23 million or 24 million Soviet citizens were killed during the course of that war. So one does understand that entirely, but the idea that, you know, once the veterans are all dead, then perhaps one can have a fresh look at the past is not entirely enough. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that. The belief in the victory is also a way of avoiding the other problems which Russia faces, its economic problems and its economic humiliation, among others.
Well, let's go back to 1945. This is, again, the sort of waning days of World War II. Berlin, as you say, was in a state of hysteria and disintegration, obviously had to withstand a lot of the air raids and the bombing. Take us to Berlin at that time and what life was like for the citizens there.
Well, roughly 90% of the inner city had been destroyed by Allied bombing, by the RAF bombing at night and the US Air Force bombing by day. For most of them, they were so exhausted by this routine. I mean, none of them slept in their own beds with the night bombing. That there was, as I say, this sense of hysteria. And then, of course, there was the idea, you know, there were 6.5 million Russian troops waiting on the border to invade in early January. So, in fact, the Berliners are famous for their black humor. And that Christmas, they were saying, be practical, give a coffin for a Christmas gift. And then come the new year, when they realized that the Russians were just about to attack, they were saying, you know, optimists were learning English and pessimists were learning Russian.
So that sort of gets us into the, I guess, the kind of survivalist gallows humor that comes from war. And it was, I'm sure, in London, the same kind of humor from the bombing as well.
It was, but it didn't have quite that black edge. I mean, the Berliners have always been famous for that sort of black humor.
The reviewer in Newsweek of this book says that this struggle, this last part of World War II, was the last great struggle between fascism and communism. Yes?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I think that sort of totalitarian clash was one of the reasons why it was so appalling, because both sides had dehumanized the other. The Nazi propaganda had portrayed the Russians as Slavs, subhumans, and all the rest of it. And, of course, Soviet propaganda referred to Berlin as the lair of the fascist beast. And back in even in 1942, there was this violation propaganda. The idea that the Germans had violated the motherland with an unprovoked attack meant that they had to pay. So those troops, Red Army troops, massing on the frontiers were ready for vengeance.
Why was Stalin so intent on taking Berlin, which he was?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I mean, the most important, or the most obvious, if you like, has always been the accepted one, is that Berlin symbolized Nazi power. Also, there was the old Marxist idea that, you know, whoever controls Germany controls Europe, and whoever controls Berlin controls Germany. So, the Europeans certainly did not lose sight of the strategic importance of Berlin. But there were other aspects too. Stalin not only wanted Berlin for symbolic reasons and for political reasons, but he also wanted it because that was where the main nuclear projects, the main nuclear laboratories were based. And as you probably know, the Russians were trying to make their own atomic bomb using material from their spies who were working within the Manhattan Project here in the United States. and the spies were passing back this material. The Russians, with Operation Borodino, as it was called, were trying to make the atomic bomb. But the one thing they lacked, and this is astonishing considering the material, the mineral wealth in Russia, one thing they lacked was uranium.
Huh.
So, in fact, one of the good reasons for going for Berlin, in fact, was the hope of getting uranium from some of these laboratories and depots.
And was it there? Was the uranium there at the nuclear
labs?
It was,
but this was the extraordinary thing was, it was one of those bureaucratic foul-ups. There had been 7 tons of uranium oxide, which had been moved down out of the way of the Russians down into the Black Forest. But then, through a bureaucratic mix-up, another 3 tons was sent there, thinking that they hadn't been relocated. So the Russians had the material to get on with the experiment.
And did Eisenhower, in a sense, allow then Stalin to take Berlin? Did he fight that effort?
No, because Eisenhower believed, I think, strongly that Berlin was, if you like, a political objective. And as far as he was concerned, the U.S. objective was simply the destruction of the German army, meeting up with the Soviets wherever that had turned out to be, and then getting out of Europe. He refused to acknowledge that there was a sort of post-war issue to be addressed. And he also felt that he shouldn't sacrifice any lives in the attack on Berlin. The trouble was, of course, that General Omar Bradley, advised him that, you know, they would lose anything up to 100,000 casualties. Mm. But in fact, the Germans were just longing to let the Americans through. We interviewed the chief of staff, amazingly still alive, 93 or 94, of the 12th Army, which was defending the Elbe opposite the Americans. And they were saying, why didn't the Americans come? You know, we were ready to let them through. But Eisenhower had said, no, we halt on the Elbe. And he felt that sort of, you know, Berlin should be left to the Russians.
You also write the Russian army was really intent on revenge on what the Nazis had done on Russian soil. What had they done?
The policy of the Nazis had been right from the start to eliminate commissars, communism in every form, but also the total extermination of all Jews there. And this, in fact, was Hitler was his opportunity. You know, the war, the invasion would push forward, in fact, brought forward the Holocaust. But the as far as the Wehrmacht was concerned, their orders were basically to pass all of their prisoners, and that we're talking about 5 million men altogether, handing them over to the most appalling regime. So, I mean, over 3 million of them died in German captivity. On the other hand, the civilians were to be more or less deported or used as slave labor, and all the food was to be taken from Russia. So basically the whole population was going to be starved into annihilation.
And you also write about, and this is just chilling, about soap from human corpses. I mean, we certainly know that from the German concentration camps, but this was also done on Russian soil.
Well, again, we found this in this archive, and the astonishing thing is, I mean, the photographs were so appalling that as we worked through them, you know, I really didn't know what to do with it, because the Russians, when they reached Danzig and found in the Anatomical Medical Institute this pilot project for taking leather from human skins, making leather from human skins and soap from the corpses. And one knows that the German government was involved, because when interrogated, they described all the senior Nazi officials, ministers even, who'd come up to see this program, and they were using the bodies of victims of the concentration camps.
And these are photographs that you've seen?
Yes. Oh, yes.
But obviously didn't use in the book, because they're not in the book.
No, you simply couldn't put them in the book.
It's just too shocking.
Yeah.
Again, we're talking about the end of World War II. You describe the German army as really sort of a ragtag assemblage of boys and old men using very primitive weapons, pictures of boys on bicycles with little rockets or little something strapped to their handlebars.
It was infanticide. I mean, Hitler was, I think, so obsessed that the German nation should perish with him that he felt that out of this was the sort of mad self-identification with the German people. Because he was going to die, they all had to die. And the terrifying thing is that the Hitler Youth had been more or less brainwashed into believing that dying for their Führer, because their country was about to be crushed, dying for their Führer was the best way to go. But yes, it was, if you like, a ragtag, because it was a mixture of members of the old Wehrmacht, but of them, most of the formations had been crushed, the Volkssturm of elderly men, these Hitler Youth, and then, of course, there were numerous groups of SS, of Waffen-SS. And the great paradox, in a way, was that Europe, Berlin, the Nazi capital of sort of the new Europe, was being defended by Waffen-SS from all these different countries, including French Waffen-SS, who'd fought through, made their way through the Russians surrounding Berlin to die defending the Führer in the Reichschancellery.
And civilians were also prevented from fleeing as well, Hitler believing that that was a form of defeat on their part.
Oh, absolutely.
How about the condition of the Soviet soldiers? Because, again, the end of the war, as you describe, many hungry, many without the kind of clothing and equipment that they needed to fight as well.
Well, the Soviet army at that particular stage was brutalized by now 3 years of really vicious warfare. And the their equipment was actually improving quite a lot. They had their guns and all their artillery and tanks, in fact, were far better than the Germans by that stage. But the great paradox, in a way, was that the reason why the Russians were able to advance as fast as they did was, in fact, due to American Lend-Lease trucks. I mean, without the Studebakers, the Dodges, and all the rest of it, there's no way that the Red Army would have been able to advance in 1943 and 1944 and get to Berlin before the Americans.
You describe them as dirty. These are the soldiers, louse-infected, increasingly ill from dysentery, in very serious physical shape.
They were, a lot of them, in very bad physical shape. And one has to remember also that many of them were also prisoners of war who'd just been released when their camps were opened. And yet they were just lined up, a gun was stuck in their hands, and they were just sent straight to the front. But even if they, this is the terrifying thing, even if they fought bravely, the fact of having surrendered to the Germans or been captured in 1941 or 1942, they were then sent to the Gulag, to a labor camp in the Gulag, once the war was over.
Your book says that 2 million German women were raped by Soviet soldiers during World War II. Was rape condoned by military officials, by the Soviet government?
Well, there's always the debate about to what degree is rape a strategy of war and all the rest of it. And that's certainly true in some wars. One can see in the Spanish Civil War, one can see in Bosnia. But as far as the Red Army is concerned, it's very difficult to actually pin that down. Stalin knew what was going on, so did Beria. I mean, we came across all of these detailed reports, Beria telling Stalin exactly what was happening. That he was telling him about the suicide of women as a result of what was being done to them and all the rest of it. But what one finds is when they hit East Prussia, there the rape was pure sadism, pure violence. But by the time they reached Berlin, it was a form almost of sexual carnal booty. They regarded women as carnal booty, and they were just sort of selecting their victims with torches, just going up and down the lines of civilians sheltering in the bomb shelters in Berlin. So by then, it really had become sort of just purely predatory. So one can't say that there was no sexual element in it at all. There was, but it was a completely different form to what had happened earlier.
But it's a form of humiliating your enemies to rape their women, so to speak.
Absolutely. No, that is entirely true. But it's a question of, I think that was the motivation at the beginning. I think by the end, it was just something that they did for their own pleasure. What is frightening, though, is the way that so many of them had to get themselves drunk before they actually had the courage to do it, which says a lot about the repression of Stalinist society. But once they got drunk and their repressions were released, the effects were terrible.
Well, and you write about Stalin's view, I guess, of sexuality. Stalin ensured the Soviet society depicted itself as virtually asexual, trying to, I guess, rid the society of any sexual feelings, any sexual, acts. Why?
Well, the idea was that basically all human emotions of affection, of love, of desire should be challenged into adoration for the party and above all for Comrade Stalin himself. This is all a part of that policy of de-individualizing the individual.
So it was, just repression? And how did he... How did he transmit this message to the Soviet people?
Well, all sex education was forbidden in schools. Any form of sexual reproduction in terms of the media arts or posters. I mean, for example, women in posters always had to be portrayed in sort of heavy dungarees as tractor workers, so as to cover the form of the breasts, because that would be regarded as sort of in some ways inflammatory. So everything was sort of desexualized in that way.
So, I mean, are you saying it was in a sense a sex-starved army?
Well, it was indeed, not only was it sex-starved, but I mean, the trouble was that it was, one Russian writer, in fact, on the subject said, and I think this is very true, he said that by repressing in this particular way, it produced a form of barracks eroticism, he described it, which was far worse than the worst form of foreign pornography. And I think that this is true. I mean, when you suppress or repress in that particular way, you achieve entirely the opposite in certain circumstances.
You interviewed some of the women who had been raped.
Yes, indeed. And actually, what is striking, and this was with the BBC, who were also filming the research of the book, and what is striking is that the a Russian interpreter brought in by the BBC to check the translation of some of these things saw the account of some of these German women about themselves being raped, and this woman said they must have enjoyed it. That was her. This is a reaction
this is today.
Of a Russian woman today. So I mean, there's a very very strong resistance to looking at the past, and even at the time, it's alarming to find how many Russian women officers and service women simply laughed at the German women victims.
That was my conversation with British military historian Anthony Beaver about his book, The Fall of Berlin, 1945. We're exploring some war history in this hour of Radio Times in Review. When we get back, we'll listen to my discussion with Diana Preston about her book, Lusitania, An Epic Tragedy. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us today. We conclude our exploration of military history by revisiting my conversation with historian Diana Preston. She joined me in 2002 to discuss the sinking of the Lusitania. That act of German aggression against the British effectively brought the U.S. into World War I. The story of this attack, which took place a century ago, is surrounded by myth and misinformation, which Preston sought to correct in her book, Lusitania, An Epic Tragedy. She also explored the human stories behind the attack. Let's take a listen.
Well, this was 1915, then the very beginning of the First World War. You even have in your book a notice, a warning to passengers who were booking a berth on the Lusitania going from New York City to Liverpool, England, basically saying travelers intending to embark on an Atlantic voyage are reminded that a state of war exists between Germany and her allies. And it goes on to say that you are traveling at your own risk.
Exactly. And you can imagine, you know, the 1st of May 1915, the day that the Lusitania was pulling out into the Hudson River for that journey across to Liverpool, you know, that caused terrific chaos, excitement down in the docks. People wondered whether it was going to be safe for them to get on board. They besieged the Cunard general manager, Charles Sumner. They said, you know, is it safest to travel? And he said, you know, sure, it's fine. You know, the Lusitania is far too swift a ship to be caught by a submarine. But what this German warning was actually all about was it was a reminder that just a few weeks earlier, in February 1915, Germany had decided to try and unblock the stalemate in the fighting on the Western Front in Europe, which had been going on since the previous August, by unleashing her U-boats, her submarines. She had declared what she called an unrestricted submarine war, which meant that henceforward her submarines would attack any merchant vessel, any enemy vessel that they encountered in the war zone which Germany declared around Great Britain. And not only that, but they would do so without giving any prior warning. And this was in contravention of the law of the time, as it was understood in 1915.
Which meant that a passenger ship, an ocean liner, could be targeted just like a military ship.
Exactly. They were saying by this that they were not going to make any distinction between a passenger liner carrying ordinary civilians and a naval vessel. That anything in the war zone, they were saying, was fair game.
Why? Why? I mean, one can understand certainly targeting military ships, but why did they want to, in a sense, target passenger liners?
They wanted to target merchant ship in general as a way, if you like, of sort of getting at Britain's jugular in the war. They thought this was a way that they could really hurt Britain. They weren't making progress militarily, but by attacking merchant ships, they could stop munitions coming from the United States over to Britain and her allies. But I think if you ask the question, well, why the Lusitania? What was it about that ship? I think it was much more about the fact that the Lusitania was a symbol of British prestige at the time. It was, if you like, a kind of World Trade Center of her day. She represented something special by showing that she had the technological skill and might to attack a ship like that. Germany felt, I think, that she would be proving something to the world about her superiority.
Boy, does that have a familiar ring to it. You did find, though, that the Lusitania did have munitions on board.
That's right. There is absolutely no doubt about that. You will find details of the ship's manifest published in the American press very shortly after the sinking. And if you look at what was on board, you will find, for instance, over 4 million live rounds of rifle ammunition. You will find shrapnel casings. You will find percussive fuses. There was no doubt that munitions were in the hold of the Lusitania, like they were in the hold of many merchant vessels leaving New York and American ports for Britain. But, of course, you know, the Lusitania, basically a passenger ship. Her cargo hold, not as big as that on some other ships. So I don't believe that it was a desire to destroy those munitions, which was actually the driving force, the driving motivation for the German attack on that ship.
Do you think passengers know, though, that the Lusitania was also carrying munitions? And this would be between the United States, who was neutral at this point in the war, to England, obviously at war with Germany.
That's right. I mean, people, I think, had quite a good appreciation of what was being conveyed in the ships of Britain and her allies between the United States and Britain. People would not have known specifically what was in the hold of the Lusitania. And it's certainly the case that if you look at the accounts of some of the survivors, it's true to say that some people actually hadn't really thought about it at all.
Right.
and really had no idea. It did come as a surprise to some people. But to anybody, you know, a bit clued up at the time, who knew really what was going on, had any knowledge really of current affairs, it would not have been a surprise.
So this particular submarine then, what, began in a sense stalking the Lusitania as it came closer to England?
Yeah, what happened was that this particular U-boat, the U-20, had set out from her port on the North German coast 30th of April, which is the day before the Lusitania had set sail. Her official orders were to go to wait outside Liverpool to attack British troop transport ships, which were known to be leaving from that port. But, of course, you know, the Liverpool port, also the home port of the Lusitania, and we know from the German files now that the captain of the U-20, like other U-boat commanders, was being very well briefed on the movements of the Lusitania. He had received a top-secret report which said, you know, 1st of May, 30,000-ton ship, Lusitania, British Cunard Line, is leaving New York. He knew she was in passage for Liverpool. He knew that he stood a very good chance of encountering her somewhere in the Irish Sea or in the approaches to Liverpool.
You have vivid descriptions in the book here of passengers who survived the Lusitania. It was in the afternoon. They'd had lunch. Many of them were on deck. And seeing this torpedo speeding towards the boat.
That's right, as you say.
Chilling, chilling descriptions.
Absolutely mesmerizing when you read them. It takes you right back as if you were there. Here you have these people on this, as you say, beautiful afternoon in May, sun shining, smudge of green on the horizon, which is the coast of Southern Ireland. People feeling that bit more secure because land is in sight. All of a sudden, you know, a cry from the starboard side that there's a torpedo in the water. People look and they see what some survivors described as looked like a giant bubble moving across the surface of the water, followed by a couple of streaks. It was like an invisible hand holding a piece of chalk. And then you have the torpedo slamming into the starboard side of the ship, almost immediately starting to tilt over to starboard, almost impossible to find your footing. You know, all of a sudden, from a calm afternoon where people are thinking about perhaps packing for their arrival in Liverpool the next day, they're suddenly faced with catastrophe, imminent disaster.
The Lusitania, it's hard to imagine a ship of this size sinking in 18 minutes. I mean, sinking completely below the water.
And that's one of the most astonishing things. You know, 30,000-ton ship hit at 2:10 p.m., at 2:28 p.m., nothing left on the water except the very few lifeboats which had managed to get away in the panic, debris, bodies. You know, what caused that? And, of course, this is one of the things which preoccupied people immediately after the sinking and which has led to, you know, a whole series of theories and ideas in subsequent generations.
Well, and the question being, how could one torpedo do such damage to such a big ship?
Exactly, exactly. Could it really account for that? Because, after all, other ships have been torpedoed, and ships not as large and as structurally tough as the Lusitania, and they hadn't sunk so far. So what had happened? And you find that this question then sort of triggered a whole series of accusations, counter-accusations, and indeed conspiracy.
And again, 18 seconds, people trying to find their children, their spouses, each other, a life jacket, the kind of pandemonium on board. Help us understand that.
Exactly. I mean, really heart-rending descriptions of what happened. You know, you have the torpedo hitting, this immediate steep list to starboard, which, of course, made it very difficult to launch the lifeboats. You can just imagine the scene on the starboard side. These lifeboats were hanging right out.
People over the water, right?
Right out of the water, yeah. People would have had to jump 8 or 10 feet to try and get into them. On the port side, these heavy boats are swinging in over the deck. It took a big effort to try and push them out over the rail so that they could be lowered. Even when people did succeed in starting to lower those boats on the port side, they just got ripped to matchwood on the rivets of the ship. And as you say, you know, terrible scenes on deck. People parted from their children. Some children were in the nursery. Some were asleep below decks in their cabins. People rushing around trying to find their loved ones. But no time. All the time the ship tilting over further and further. People slithering about on the decks. You have descriptions of prams careering wildly. Children crying. People screaming. You know, people trying in all that chaos to help one another. But time running out. You know, people observing with incredulity that the bow of the ship is starting to go under the waves, that the water is coming nearer. People starting to think, well, there's no time to try and get lifeboats away. I've got no option. I'm going to have to get on the rail. I'm going to have to jump. You know, women tied babies in shawls around their necks and leapt over the side. You have people running around, scooping up any children they could find and just handing them, first of all, to people in the
perfect
few lifeboats that
perhaps
were being lowered. Perfect strangers, absolutely. Sometimes throwing the children over the side because it seemed, in the circumstances, the only thing to do.
Hmm. One of the descriptions about the ship going down was this long, lingering moan. And I'm trying to imagine that, of course, with the screams and shouts of the human cargo.
That's right. You know, you had a sea littered with bodies, people injured because there have been explosions on board. They've been injured by debris. People already starting to drown. Many people in all the chaos have put their life jackets on the wrong way. So you had people who sort of put legs in where arms should have been. So people were floundering in the water. They were trying to find a piece of wreckage to cling to, anything. You know, people sat on dog kennels. They grabbed hold of a grand piano. Sometimes they grabbed hold of each other in the panic, just anything to try and stay afloat. And this terrible noise that I think people who had experienced it, who heard it, never forgot.
Again, there's you have come to the conclusion that it was one torpedo that was able to do this to the Lusitania. How so?
That's right. Well, the reason that I'm absolutely convinced that it was one torpedo is that when the German U-boat captain got back within radio range of the German coast, he sent a message back to his superiors. He said, I have sunk the Lusitania with one torpedo. The British Admiralty had broken the German codes. They intercepted that telegram. It's sitting now in the British archives. Go and take a look at it. It's very clear that it was one torpedo. And it's very clear, if you look at the number of torpedoes that the captain was carrying, that that's all he had fired. But, of course, this leads to the question, well, how could one torpedo do so much damage?
Exactly.
And the reason I believe that the ship sank so fast was the structural point at which that torpedo hit. You know, it punched a hole in the side of the ship beneath the bridge, 10 feet below the water, hitting a very strategic bulkhead. Water began to pour in. It was flooding into the longitudinal bulkheads where the coal was stored along the side of the ship. So the ship starts to tilt over to the right. The ship is still making way. You're talking about a ship doing 18 knots through the water. So think of the effect of that on water pouring in. Mm. You have vibrations being set up internally, rivets popping, plates dropping off, even more water now pouring in, the ship going over yet further, that water starting to get right down into the bowels of the ship, causing the steam lines to start to explode, the boilers themselves to blow up, which I think accounts for the secondary and tertiary explosions that so many people reported hearing.
Does it also reflect the kind of competitive spirit, I guess, between England and Germany about naval warfare, about who was going to control the seas at the time?
Was there to an extent it does. I mean, the Lusitania was very emblematic of Britain's determination, if you like, to control, to dominate the seas. That was one of the reasons why she'd been built in the first place, because of an intense rivalry, an Anglo-German rivalry about ocean liners. But in 1915, I think, you know, the main preoccupation was to maximise, to build on the propaganda advantage that Britain had been given. You have this completely shocked reaction from around the world. Germany had totally misjudged the situation. Germany thought by sinking the Lusitania that she would be hailed as a country of, you know, technological progress, that her military might would be admired. Within about 48 hours, if you read the German files, you find Germany trying to distance herself from the sinking, to say Captain hadn't known what he was really firing at. It all happened a little bit by accident. And you see also, you know, on the British files, the British government absolutely determined that there should be no question that there were any other factors involved than German culpability. You know, the whole irony was, as I was just saying earlier, that I don't believe that exploding munitions had anything to do with the sinking, but the British government didn't know that at the time. Well, what was the relationship between Britain and the United States over this period? Because, of course, America, a neutral country under the administration of Woodrow Wilson, with a very committed neutral William Jennings Bryan as Secretary of State. So what was actually going on about the supply of war material between the United States and Britain and her allies? Well, if you're looking at this time, 1915, perfectly legal for America to have been supplying war material to countries at war with one another.
And remain neutral. I mean,
absolutely. That's right. I mean, theoretically, you know, Germany could have been supplying as much could have been purchasing as much war material as Britain. Germany had a problem in sort of taking such consignments because of a British blockade. They couldn't actually get the material through. But you have the situation in 1915 with four or five major factories at least supplying munitions to Britain. How is that being financed? Well, in spite of the misgivings of William Jennings Bryan, who thought of money as the worst of all contrabands, a kind of arrangement, a sort of very legalistic arrangement, had been put in place by Robert Lansing, then Chancellor to the State Department, which President Wilson had agreed to. And under this, America wasn't actually loaning Britain money to buy these munitions, but it was extending her credit. So rather a sort of hair-splitting distinction. So if you like, plenty of munitions going across the Atlantic, being financed through this arrangement of extension of credit, being administered by the firm of J.P. Morgan. So you have all of that happening. Why was the Lusitania not provided with a naval escort? I found no evidence in my research that on that May voyage there had ever been any intention to escort the Lusitania on that journey in May 1915. I think, you know, the Admiralty's thoughts were elsewhere. They were complacent. They didn't think she would be attacked. They didn't do it. I do not believe there's evidence that particular ship, the Juno, was actually recalled. And there's one extra dimension I'll just add to that, that if there had been a naval escort supplied to the Lusitania, it would have changed her nature from being just a passenger ship, which could not, under the law of the time, be attacked without warning. It would have given her the character of an auxiliary naval vessel under which anything would have gone.
That was my 2002 interview with historian Diana Preston, who joined me to discuss her book, Lusitania, an Epic Tragedy. And that wraps up the War History edition of Radio Times in Review. Tell us what you think of the show. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.